Cale Clark here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Relevant Radio and get a free phone. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com.
Fascinating facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
A terrific Tuesday to you. It is November the 22nd, 2022, and I'm happy to be talking to you. I like to say things that rhyme, apparently. You can call me right now, 888-914-9149. Once again, 888-914-9149 to talk to me for free on The Cale Clark Show. Producer Jim has paid for these phone calls. He's got a stack of quarters on his desk. Remember when you had to do that? 888-914-9149. Perhaps you are on the road. Perhaps you're going to see friends and family getting ready for Thanksgiving. If so, enjoy the next hour with me. I think it's going to be a lot of fun, and I'd love to have that conversation with you. So just a note, too, you can follow me on Twitter at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. The show account is at Cale Clark Show, and you can email the program, cale@relevantradio.com. And producer Jim reminded me at the end of the show, a religious sister, a nun, emailed me yesterday. It was a great email. I want to read that on the air, so don't let me forget. But today, of course, November the 22nd, lots of stuff going on. It's the feast day of St. Cecilia. Cecilia, you're breaking my heart. No, different Cecilia, of course, St. Cecilia. But it's also, on this day, this is incredible, on this day, 59 years ago, in 1963, John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Also, the writer Aldous Huxley died on this day, who wrote Brave New World. And C.S. Lewis, the great Christian apologist, who never made it into the Catholic Church for various reasons, but he held a lot of Catholic beliefs. He also died on this day in 1963. And in fact, Peter Kraft, who's a friend of the program, guest on the show before, he wrote a famous book about this, which I've never read. This is one of Crave's books that I haven't read. It's called Between Heaven and Hell, and it's kind of a post-mortem conversation in the afterlife between John F. Kennedy, who, of course, was the first Catholic president of the United States, C.S. Lewis, and Aldous Huxley. And so C.S. Lewis was somebody who made a huge impression on my life, not because of the Narnia books, which I've never read. I must confess, I'm not really a fiction guy, unless it comes to comic book stuff, but that's not exactly highbrow stuff. I know I'm kind of wrecking my Catholic street cred by saying this, but I've never read The Lord of the Rings. I have seen the movies, though. I have seen the movies. And they always seem like they're going to end, and then it keeps going, and then it seems like it's going to end, and then it keeps going. But I did see the Narnia movie as well, so that has to count for something. Maybe not. But having said that, obviously C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien were good friends. They were part of a group called the Inklings. They used to meet at a pub, the Eagle and Child pub, near Oxford University. And you might recall, I'll try to post this in the show notes as well, we had an incredible program some months ago featuring Father Michael Ward. And he wrote this book called After Humanity, which is an exploration of another book. It's a book about a book by C.S. Lewis called The Abolition of Man, which is an intriguing work. And Father Ward was also in a movie about C.S. Lewis, which was filmed not too long ago. He plays a priest, which comes naturally to him. That was one of the best conversations I think we've ever had on the show. So we can find that. Let's try to put that in the show notes. But C.S. Lewis was huge on my journey, my Christian journey. Before I came back into the Catholic Church, I read his book, Mere Christianity. So, yeah, the fictional stuff I wasn't really into, but I was super into Mere Christianity, which was actually started off kind of like something like this. It was a radio show that Lewis did back in World War II in England, and an explanation of Christian faith. Now, why does he say Mere Christianity? Well, basically what he was looking at were the minimal facts, I guess you could say. What are the minimal things you need to believe to be a Christian? Now, this is where we might get into some arguments. How do you know that these are the things? Or why don't we add one more thing or two more things to the list? We can talk about that till the cows come home. And Lewis himself, even in the book, he does say that, you have to, mere Christianity can get you in the door. This is the baseline of beliefs that all Christians would share about Jesus, about the faith. Now, I think, again, you have to be more of a maximalist with this. That's what really what the Catholic position is. But he said, look, that'll get you in the door. And I'm paraphrasing him here, but you have to live in one of the rooms. So he kind of viewed it as a great big house where there's a Catholic room over here, there's an Anglican room over there, there's the Baptists are down the hall. You have to live in one of the rooms. You can't just live in the foyer. You can't just roll out your sleeping bag and stay there. You've got to make a commitment to an ecclesial body. That is some sort of organization that claims to be a church or the church. And certainly the Catholic Church claims to be the church founded by Jesus Christ. You're listening to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 888-914-9149. C.S. Lewis died, as did Jack Kennedy and Aldous Huxley on this day in 1963. Fateful day. And I titled this show, Do You Know Jack? And that's a bit of a pun, a tortured pun at that. C.S. Lewis, his nickname was Jack. He was called Jack by his friends. Of course, John F. Kennedy was also known as Jack Kennedy. It's the best I can do. It's the best I can do at this hour. But one of the arguments that C.S. Lewis had that really, really struck me, and I found that this really does work when you're trying to have conversations with non-Christians, non-Catholics maybe, who are a little bit skeptical. They live in this relativistic air in which we all breathe, and we're a little bit like the frog, the proverbial frog in the pot of boiling water. We don't even know we're surrounded by this at times, this culture of relativism, as Pope Benedict XVI called it, the dictatorship of relativism. Well, C.S. Lewis had a great argument about the nature of universal morality, which a lot of people want to deny. And again, like I said, he never did become a Catholic, but it's one of the, maybe it's not such a great mystery. I talked to a biographer of C.S. Lewis once who said that he just couldn't get over his anti-Catholic biases of his upbringing, growing up in Dublin and being exposed to a lot of anti-Catholicism over his life. He just found it hard to overcome. Now, is that true? Is that the reason? I don't know. Maybe others might disagree, but he espoused Eucharistic realism. He believed in the real presence. I'm not saying that the Anglicans have the real presence. They don't, but he did believe in that. He believed in an all-male ministerial priesthood. He believed in auricular confession, that is, confessing your sins out loud in the confessional, and other things. But one of the most powerful arguments that he makes in Mere Christianity is actually the very first one that he makes, if you read the book. And I totally recommend that you read the book. You might want to pick that up over Thanksgiving weekend and check it out. He basically asks the question, what is the existence of a universal moral law? What does that imply about the existence of God? Now, again, people will fight you on this. They'll say there is no universal moral law. And he begins his argument with a statement that might seem a little bit off topic. He says, everybody has heard people quarreling. Everybody has heard people fighting. No doubt, no doubt. People argue about all kinds of things, about sports, chocolate or vanilla. I'm a vanilla guy. I like vanilla, but I'm not going to turn it down if somebody gives me a double chocolate fudge either. But he says that you really see this, though. You really hear people arguing when they feel like they've been mistreated. People will say things like, how would you like that if somebody did that to you? Or they'll say, come on, you promised. You promised. You know, you're reneging. You're not being fair. And so here's what C.S. Lewis says in the book. I'm going to quote him here. He says, what interests me about all these remarks is that the man who makes them is not merely saying that the other man's behavior does not happen to please him. He's appealing to some kind of standard of behavior, which he expects the other man to know about. And the other man very seldom replies, to hell with your standard. Okay, end of quote. Okay, so he said the word H-E double hockey sticks. I didn't say that. So that Lewis quoted there. So by the way, what's your favorite C.S. Lewis book? If you have one, call in 888-914-9149. Was he in any way influential or a seminal figure on your faith journey? Love to hear about it. It's the Cale Clark Show, 888-914-9149. So Basically, Lewis says that when people argue, they're appealing to a standard of behavior. You can call it fairness, you can call it whatever, justice. And you expect your dialogue partner to know about this. Nobody ever says, well, what are you talking about? This concept of what's fair. Now, again, Mere Christianity was a series of BBC radio talks that C.S. Lewis gave between the year 1942 and 1944. And some people might say, well, that argument might have worked back then, mid-20th century, but when somebody says to heck with your standard, that's exactly what the average person on the street would say today. That's what the dictatorship of relativism is all about. People don't believe that universal truth exists. But of course, the great trap there that people don't even realize they're stepping into is when people say there is no objective truth, that is a truth statement. People who say this think they're correct. They think they're right. So we really can't get away from this idea of truth, can we? And this is why nobody actually lives this way. People might say, well, I'm a moral relativist, or I don't believe that anybody should impose their morality on anybody else. But nobody, they can say all they want, but nobody actually believes that. There's an influential Protestant minister, a Presbyterian pastor by the name of Tim Keller. And he's written a lot of best-selling books, and he's really kind of good at taking apart, deconstructing the mind of the modern agnostic. He wrote this book called The Reason for God. And he, by the way, he ministers in New York City, and he often, most of the crowd that he ministers to in his Presbyterian church are 20-somethings, they're millennials, they're kind of jaded by the world, whatever. Anyways, this is what Tim Keller says in his book, The Reason for God. I'm going to quote him here. We as Catholics can certainly pick this up and use this. He says, quote, conservative writers and speakers are constantly complaining that the young people of our culture are relativistic and amoral. That's another way of saying immoral. They're relativistic and amoral. As a pastor in Manhattan, I have been neck deep in sophisticated 20-somethings for almost 2 decades, and I have not found this to be the case. The secular young adults I have known have a very finely honed sense of right and wrong. There are many things happening in the world that evoke their moral outrage. End of quote. And that's a good point. So even millennials, even 20-somethings today, even teenagers, there are things that evoke their moral outrage, even if they say that they're relativists. Now, don't forget, relativism, even though it's kind of out there now, it's sort of fully grown. It was kind of getting started way back in 1940s England in the academy, and things always tend to trickle down from the universities, from the ivory, you know, towers of academia, and they eventually trickle down the mountain and water the stream below. So if the intellectuals of society are talking about something, be assured that in a few years it's going to be on social media as well. So in 1940s England, the academy was certainly talking about this concept of relativism, even if it wasn't talked about on street level. And this is what C.S. Lewis wrote about this. He said this. He says, and this is in Mere Christianity, he wrote, "The most remarkable thing is this. Whenever you find a man who says he does not believe in a real right and wrong," and by the way, he capitalizes those words, capital R, capital W. "Whenever you find a man who says he does not believe in a real right and wrong, you will find the same man going back on this a moment later. He may break his promise to you, but if you try breaking one to him, he'll be complaining it's not fair before you can say Jack Robinson." I have no idea who Jack Robinson is. Maybe I don't think he's thinking about Jackie Robinson, the baseball player. But anyways, having said that, "A nation may say treaties do not matter, but then the next minute they spoil their case by saying the treaty they want to break was an unfair one. But if treaties do not matter, and if there is no such thing as right and wrong, in other words, if there is no law of nature, what is the difference between a fair treaty and an unfair one? Have they not let the cat out of the bag and shown that whatever they say, they really know the law of nature just like anyone else? It seems, then, that we are forced to believe in a real right and wrong." You're listening to the K.O. Clark Show on Relevant Radio. We're talking about C.S. Lewis on the 59th anniversary of his death. So what's the ultimate point here in what he's saying in Mere Christianity? Well, he basically wants his listeners, and again, these are radio shows that he did. So he started off with listeners, just like we have listeners here on Relevant Radio, people like you, fine people like you. So he wanted his listeners to understand three things. Number one, there is a universal moral law, which applies to everybody. Now, whether or not people explicitly believe in such a thing, they appeal to it all the time. They complain they're the victim when somebody else doesn't obey the moral law. They attempt to excuse themselves when they don't obey it personally. Well, you know, in my case, I made an exception. And this leads us to point number two. Point number two is this. All of us are, or all of us have been, or all of us will be, breakers of this moral law. We all sin. That's what sin really is. It's missing the mark. Only people who are truly delusional or who never examine their conscience would ever deny this. And some people don't examine their conscience. Let's face it. And I think that that's one of the reasons why the confessional lines, I think, are so short in parishes today, because people aren't doing a daily examination of conscience. They're not doing a weekly examination of conscience. So, you know, as somebody once said, I'll try to remember this line, if your conscience is clear, that means that you have a really bad memory or something like that. So that's true. We all sin. So the third point that Lewis wants to get across to us is that there is this moral law, and the existence of the universal moral law, it strongly implies a moral law giver. And where did this moral law come from? It strongly implies a moral law giver or a moral law maker. Now, we would call this moral law giver God, but we're not quite there yet. We're not quite there yet. And Lewis himself says this in the book. And again, this is how he opens the book. He gets into stuff about Jesus later on. But as he says, hey, we are not yet within 100 miles of the God of Christian theology. So we're not quite there when it comes to the Judeo-Christian concept of God, the divinity of Christ, the Trinity. But it's a starting point. This idea of the universal moral law, it's a starting point. And that's why he starts off Mere Christianity with this argument. And I believe it's also a starting point that you and me, you know, we can take this. We can engage secular people in discussions about ultimate reality. There is a universal moral law that exists, which in turn strongly implies the existence of God. So, food for thought. Food for thought as we gear up to eat a lot of food, hopefully of another sort for Thanksgiving. We're going to be right back with your phone calls. If you're on the line, please stay there. 888-914-9149 is the number to call for the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. And coming up, the Son of Man came eating and drinking. That's what Jesus says. You know, that's very appropriate for Thanksgiving. So some more food for thought about that after the break. 888-914-9149. It's Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. Hi, this is Cale Clark. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. They're a pro-life phone company, and 5% of your monthly plan price goes to Relevant Radio or another pro-life charity of your choice. For a limited time, new customers who mention offer code Relevant Radio get a free phone with free activation and free shipping. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com. The Catholic Order of Foresters, the sponsor of our studio's line, is hiring today. Several positions are available throughout the United States. Visit relevantradio.com/forester to learn more about how you can find your vocation with Catholic Order of Foresters, an Illinois Life Insurance Society, not licensed in all states.
Helping you keep your mind off traffic and on the more important things in life. It's Cale Clark on Relevant Radio.
That's right. And you can call in as well, 888-914-9149. If you're on the road, traffic jam, trying to get home to see friends and family for Thanksgiving, getting an early jump. Why don't you get an early jump on these open phone lines? We got a couple here, 888-914-9149. Let's go to the phones right now. Mary is calling from Boston. Hi, Mary. Hi, Mary. You're on the air. Can you hear me? Okay, we'll try to reestablish the connection with Mary. So Mary, if you're on the line, stay there. We will try to get back to you in just a few moments. Well, as I mentioned, a lot of you guys are pretty excited, as am I, about Thanksgiving. And yeah, even though I'm Canadian, we had our Thanksgiving back in October. I double dip. I'm a dual citizen when it comes to Thanksgiving, that's for sure. I do both. So I'm looking forward to U.S. Thanksgiving too, especially because there's a lot of NFL football on Thanksgiving, and I plan on imbibing in that. And speaking of imbibing, one of the most interesting things about our Lord is that Scripture says he came eating and drinking to the point where people actually accused him of being a glutton and a drunkard. Now, was he? Absolutely not. He's the incarnate Son of God, sinless. Don't worry about that. But it does tell us something about him. And I read an interesting piece written by Tim Chester, who actually got his PhD from the University of Wales. And Wales played the United States at the World Cup yesterday. And I heard a lot of jokes about kids thinking there will be actual whales on the soccer pitch. No. Sorry to disappoint. But anyways, Tim Chester wrote a book called A Meal with Jesus. And I wrote a little article about this too. Jesus is eating and drinking, and starts off by talking about how he fell in love with his wife. And I'm just going to quote him here. This is Tim Chester. He said, quote, "I fell in love with my wife while she was making me cheese on toast." He said, "I'd only known her for a few weeks. It had been love at first sight for me, except, of course, that my initial love was mere attraction." And let me just stop right there. Actually, another book that C.S. Lewis wrote was called The Four Loves. And he goes through the Greek word for love, the Greek words for love. There's more than one. There's, of course, this agape love, this self-giving love, which is the ideal. There's also, of course, erotic love. There's friendship love, filio, from which we get the name Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. There's all that sort of stuff. And Tim Chester says that his initial quote-unquote love for his wife was nothing more than mere attraction. It has to start somewhere, right? But he's right. What we say love at first sight, but it's really not. It's more attraction. And he says, no, it was the cheese on toast that she made for me that won my heart. It wasn't that she could make cheese on toast. I was looking for a little more than that in a wife, but the simple act of service done without thought to herself captured my heart. And I just knew that she was the one for me, end of quote. So he goes on to say that he spent now more than half his life with that same girl who once made him cheese on toast, half a lifetime of shared meals. And she said, and he says, look, every time she cooks a meal for me, I think of it as a gift, and I express my appreciation every time. And I'm just delighted. It's not just the food, he says. Each meal is an embodiment of her love for me. Obviously, guys can do the cooking too. Producer Jim Shaper is an excellent chef. I know this. He's invited me to his home, and I've had dinner with his family, and I'm sure that he'll be cooking up an amazing deep-fried turkey this week. So anyways, having said that, back to Tim Chester. He talks about how every meal that he has with his wife is kind of an embodiment of her love for him and for their daughters and for their guests. And the cooking gives tangible and edible form to her love. Because food matters, he says. Meals matter. They're full of significance. And one writer has said this, few acts are more expressive of companionship than the shared meal. Someone with whom we share food is likely to be our friend or well on the way to becoming one, end of quote. That's very true. Now, Uncle Billy Bob at the Thanksgiving table, maybe he's an exception, but usually somebody who we share the table with is going to be our friend or is well on the way to becoming one. I like that. Now, fill in the blanks here. He kind of gives us a little experiment. He says, how would you complete this sentence? The Son of Man came X, you know, to do what? The Son of Man came preaching the word, to establish the kingdom of God, to die on the cross, to rise again. There's so many things you could say. But when you read the New Testament, there are only three ways that sentence can be properly finished off. Because it does say that three times in the New Testament. The Son of Man, and that's obviously a reference to Jesus, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. That's in Mark chapter 10, verse 45. Great to think about Jesus washing the feet, which was a very lowly servant's task. at the Last Supper, as we do gather with friends and loved ones over Thanksgiving, think about some ways that you can be of service and really emulate Christ the servant in that way. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Here's another sentence where that comes in. The Son of Man came to do what? To seek and to save the lost. Luke 19:10. Okay, so he came to serve, he came to seek and save the lost. And then there's one more. This also comes from Luke's Gospel, Luke 7:34. The Son of Man has come eating and drinking. Well, that seems a little bit out of place. It seems a little random, but maybe not. Maybe there's some deep thoughts we can have here about this. Well, I never get tired of talking about this, how Christians are very confused about Jesus when he talks about himself as the Son of Man. Some people think that's a reference to his human nature in the incarnation. No. Or Son of God is a reference to his divinity. No. In fact, all Israelites were called sons and daughters of God. Okay, so it applied to all the people. Son of Man, actually, it's probably backwards. Actually, Son of Man probably applies more to his divinity. That comes from Daniel chapter 7, that very famous passage. And Daniel has this vision, and he sees one like a Son of Man who approaches a figure known as the Ancient of Days. And this is God the Father. And he receives from this Ancient of Days a kingdom, power, glory, and all tribes, peoples, nations, and languages, everybody worships him. And he's coming on a cloud with great power and glory. We talked about this. This is the storm cloud. It's not a white puffy cloud. It's a storm cloud. And he is the storm God. This is really a reference to Yahweh in the Old Testament. And so, wow, this is amazing. So basically, Daniel doesn't quite know, is this a human figure? Is he divine? Is he a little of both? This is actually the God-man, Jesus Christ. So this is what, when Jesus says, the Son of Man, well, you'll see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven. The high priest freaks out. He's talking about sitting next to the Father on the chariot throne of God with the clouds of heaven. You can keep your off-road 4x4s. This is the real, you know, hot rod. This is the heavenly rig that's going to throw down bolts of lightning. And wow, it's wild stuff. So this is what Jesus says about himself. Now, when he says the Son of Man has come eating and drinking, you say, look at him, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners, Luke 7:34. Now, Jesus was not actually guilty of these sins, of course. Drunkenness is a mortal sin. Always keep that in mind. A glutton is somebody who overeats. These are seven deadly sins, right? Gluttony is one of them. So, but here's the thing. Jesus did eat and drink. And in fact, he did it a lot, so much so that people actually thought he was going overboard. Was he? No. But it was an easy accusation to lob at him. Now, earlier in Luke's gospel, and this is something that Tim Chester points out, the Pharisees kind of say this to Jesus. They say this, hey, well, what about John the Baptist? You know, he was pretty austere, locusts and wild honey. Come on, this is super kosher, right? I mean, the disciples of John, they fast all the time. They pray all the time. The disciples of the Pharisees, hey, we do the same. But you guys are eating and drinking. What's up with that? What's up with that? Luke 5:33. That's not in the text. What's up with that? But Jesus did that. He ate and drank, and he spent a lot of time doing that. Now, why is that? He had a lot of long meals that would stretch into the evening. It's because he was doing evangelism. He was doing apostolate and forming disciples around the table. And by the way, if you read Luke's gospel, it might make you hungry because they're full. It's just chock full of accounts of Jesus eating with people. In Luke chapter 5, he eats with tax collectors and sinners at the home of Levi. He's not the creator of Levi's jeans. Of course, that's Matthew. That's Matthew the apostle. He has kind of a Matthew party, invites all his friends. Hey, check this Jesus guy out. You got to meet him. And they have a wonderful time together. And, you know, a lot of the scribes, authorities, they don't like this. They're like, hey, what is this guy doing? Why is he eating and drinking with sinners? And Jesus says, well, it's because they need help. It's not a healthy person who needs a doctor. It's the sick. And I'm trying to help them. So Luke chapter 7, two chapters later, he goes to the house of Simon the Pharisee. That's another famous account. You got to read that, Luke 7. Luke chapter 9, food is involved again. He feeds the 5,000, does the great miracle. In Luke 10, he goes to the house of Martha and Mary, sisters of Lazarus in Bethany. Very, very close to this family. And there's a place where he could go. He could always hang out with them and be refreshed. Luke chapter 11. What does he do? He's at a meal. And while he's at that meal, he takes some shots at the Pharisees, the teachers of the law, and says, you guys are nuts. Luke 14. Again, another meal setting. And this is where he uses the opportunity, uses the food, the dinner, as an object lesson, and says, you need to invite the poor, the crippled, the blind, the lame, to your feasts. They can't pay you back. Usually when somebody invites you out for lunch, you return the favor. Well, these guys can't do that for you. They have no means, no resources, but you'll be blessed if you invite them. Luke chapter 19, Jesus invites himself over to somebody's house. Zacchaeus, remember little Zacchaeus? He goes up the tree, the sycamore tree, so he can see Jesus. And, oh, Zacchaeus, I'm coming to your house for dinner today. And he's like, awesome, this is amazing. So, hey, I'll order in. From Benihana or something, I don't know. Luke chapter 22, of course, the most famous meal of all, the Last Supper, the first Mass. And then in Luke chapter 24, what does he do? Not that he needs food. He eats with after the resurrection to prove that he's corporal, prove that he's physical. Hey, do you have anything here to eat? Yeah, I've got some fish and some bread. Filet-O fish. Okay, I'll eat it. Bang. Ghosts don't make food disappear. I'm not a ghost. I'm not a spirit. And then, of course, it's at the meal, before this happens, the road to Emmaus, right? He's walking with the two disciples. They invite him in for a meal. That's when he breaks the bread. Aha. And then he disappears. Why? Because he doesn't want his physical presence in his resurrected body to detract from his Eucharistic presence. That's what some scholars say. So as one writer says, Robert Karras, he says in Luke's gospel, Jesus is either going to a meal, he's at a meal, or he's just come out of a meal. All right, so this is totally centered around food. This is all over the place. The great banquet parable, again, that's the one in Luke 14. The prodigal son, that's also in Luke's gospel. What happens? This great meal, they kill the fatted calf, right? Luke chapter 15, of course, the rich man and Lazarus, the beggar in that parable. Lazarus, he just wants the crumbs that fall from the rich man's table. And there are all these women who provide food for Jesus out of their means in Luke chapter 8 and the apostles as well. They ask him, the apostles ask him, hey, who's going to make it to heaven, Jesus? This is a very, very important question that a lot of people ask. Who's in? Who's out? Jesus says, hey, don't stress about that. Strive to enter in. Strive to enter in. But he starts talking about that when they ask him, oh, will many be saved? Will few be saved? And Jesus says, look, on the last day, people will say this to me. Hey, we ate and drank in your presence. You taught in our streets. But the master of the house will say, I do not know where you come from. Depart from me. So, okay, well, we thought we were in with you, but maybe not. But Jesus says, instead, people will come from the east, from the west, from the north, from the south, and they will recline at table in the kingdom of God. Now, that's what people did. When they had these meals, like the Last Supper, they weren't tables and chairs. There'd be this low table, and very often it was made of stone, and they would kind of recline. They'd be on their, like, propped up on their elbow, and they'd be kind of, you know, chilling out, and they'd kind of eat that way. So they recline at the table in the kingdom of God. That's why Jesus says this. In Luke chapter 22, Jesus says, I assign to you, or I covenant to you, a kingdom, just as my Father covenanted to me a kingdom, that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom. So this is all over the place in the Gospel of Luke. And there's even more, which I'm not going to tell you about because it's just too much. I think you get the point. So Jesus took advantage of meals to share his love, to share his grace, to get to know people. And this is what we can do as well. And maybe we can take this mindset into Thanksgiving because we're going to be obviously connected with a lot of people who are offline with the faith, who are maybe claim to be atheists, or they're agnostics, or they're non-practicing Catholics, or they're people of another faith. And there might be opportunities. Now, I know what they say. The two things you're not supposed to talk about at get-togethers are politics and religion. Well, we've never let that stop us before, right? G.K. Chesterton said this. He said, I always find that kind of strange because these are the two most important topics. Because politics has to do, well, religion has to do with love of God. Politics has to do with love of neighbor. If you really think about it, it's how can we serve our neighbor in society better? That's what it's supposed to be all about. So it's weird that people don't want to talk about this. But of course, passions can run high. People want to go along to get along. You don't want to rock the boat. You don't want the cranberry sauce to be thrown across the room. It's stuck to the wall. And yeah, it might actually stick to the wall. I don't know. I've never tried it. But having said that, we can sort of take Jesus' example of evangelism, sharing the faith over good conversations, good meals, friendship. And again, we don't want to instrumentalize friendships with people. We want to be friends. We'd want to be friends with them anyways, even if they never convert. That we don't look at them as apostolic notches on our belt. Okay, that guy converted, now I'm on to the next person. No, we actually maintain our friendships. And when people reject the gospel, they actually need our friendships even more. And by the way, we will get your phone calls again, 888-914-9149. I think Mary's come back. We've got her back. Some other folks are on the line. We've got a couple open lines too. If you want to stay there, we will get to you. 888-914-9149, time permitting. But the bottom line is that we should really be thinking about meals, food, social occasions, the way that Jesus did. I love this because people are usually pretty open when you're having a meal with somebody. They're more relaxed. They're willing to talk. It's a good thing to do. If you can try to do this, you know, maybe a couple times a month, like meet with a friend that you're concerned about their soul. And this is it. I mean, because people try to have all these strategies. And this is one of the things that Tim Chester talks about in his article. There are all these strategies, how to get more people to come to church. What will appeal to them? Should we change the music? Should we think about postmodernism a little bit more? How can we work that into our homilies and deal with that? Can we reference more movies? And maybe even show movie clips. I know a priest who actually does that. He sets up a screen. And this is something that you see in a lot of evangelical churches, but he'll show movie clips during his homily. Does it work? I don't know. But he's trying to be cutting edge, trying to reach people. But maybe we need to get back to basics here. Maybe we need to do what Jesus did. The Son of Man came eating and drinking. Not just for food's sake. We're not just talking, you know, enough to stay alive here. I mean, he enjoyed the meal. Was he a glutton? Was he a drunkard? Absolutely not. But I think he enjoyed the company, enjoyed the meal. I think people enjoyed being with him, obviously. Obviously. So this takes some effort on our part. It's a pain sometimes to invite people over. You got to clean the house and all that stuff. I got to take time out of your schedule. I'd rather just stay home and watch football. No, you got to get out there and try to get out of your comfort zone and have a passion for bringing people to the only meal that really counts, right? The bread of life. The Eucharist, that's the goal, that they can feast on the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ. Sacramental manner, of course, in an unbloody manner, but that's where they'll really be satisfied. And that's where they can really give thanks. And that's what Eucharist means, as we know, Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving. And so, just a little food for thought for you as we lead up to the big holiday. We'll be right back with your phone calls on the Cale Clark Show, 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. BRB, as they say. I'll be right back. I'm hip. I'm cool. Today, we'd like to thank Matthew, who's listening in New Hampshire, for donating his Mercedes. You can join thousands of other listeners in donating old vehicles by visiting relevantradio.com/car today.
Explaining the Catholic faith and how you can live it and share it too. It's the Cale Clark Show. Have a question? Give Cale a call at 888-914-9149.
That's right. That number once again is 80. I think I just said the same thing twice. That number again, once again. You know, I heard it's kind of off topic here, but I got to say this. You've heard about double negatives, right? In a lot of other languages, apparently, when you say a negative twice, it's kind of a reiteration of that negative, like bad, bad, something like that. It's really bad. or something's good, you know, good, you know, fantastic in different languages. But in English, we have the double negative. If it's a double negative, it's actually a positive. It's actually a positive. But I heard about a teacher who was trying to explain this concept to his students. And he said, what's interesting about the English language is that we have these double negatives, but there's no such thing. There's no language in the world, in fact, that has a double positive. There's double negatives, but there's no double positives. And there's a kid in the back who said, yeah, right. So maybe he was wrong about that. Anyways, having said that, 888-914-9149. Let's go back to the phones. Mary is calling from Boston. We got her back. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Cale. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks. Thanks for being patient. We were able to reestablish the connection with you. So good to be talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I wanted to tell you about my C.S. Lewis encounter.
Yes. Yeah, let's hear it.
I grew up Catholic, but I'd kind of wandered away from the faith. And for a while, I didn't actually believe that the devil existed. You know, people could reject God, but not in some evil entity kind of thing. And then I was reading C.S. Lewis, The Screwtape Letters. And it was while I was reading that, that, you know, all those little hairs stood up on the back of my neck. And I went, oh my, he does exist. And so after that, if there's someone who's, you know, a real entity that's trying to drag me down, I kind of need to rethink what I'm doing here. And then I ended up going back to church.
That's amazing. And by the way, Mary, I don't think you're alone in this. I think there are a lot of Catholics who don't buy into this concept of the devil. And in fact, one interesting factoid about C.S. Lewis is that he was on the cover of Time magazine once, and it was for The Screwtape Letters. Is because of that. And the image of C.S. Lewis, and I've only read about this, I haven't actually seen the image, but the image of C.S. Lewis on the cover of Time magazine, he had an angel on one shoulder and a little devil on the other shoulder, just like we see in cartoons and in the movies. And it was all about the Screwtape Letters. And for those of you who might not have read this, the Screwtape Letters is about, essentially, it's an imaginary conversation between a senior demon and a junior demon. He's kind of trying to show him the ropes. Here's how we mess up humanity here and get them off track, get them away from God. And I think a lot of Catholics kind of, they buy into the faith, but not certain parts of it. They kind of treat the faith almost like a cafeteria patron would. You know, we've obviously heard the phrase cafeteria Catholics. And another great convert to the faith from England, of course, was Ronald Knox. And I just, Mary, stay on the line with me for just a second because I want to ask you about something. But Ronald Knox was a very famous Anglican priest. He was kind of in the mold of John Henry Newman, St. John Henry Newman, and he converted to Catholicism. And he wrote one of the most, if not the best book on apologetics I think I've ever read. It's in the top three. It's called The Belief of Catholics. You can get a copy of it, by the way. It's published by Ignatius Press. It's still out there. He published it in 1927. It's still just as fresh today as it ever was. So it's right up there with Mere Christianity in terms of classic apologetic works. But in his book, The Belief of Catholics, 1927 was a good year. The 27 Yankees, you know, this book came out too. It was solid. And he had a great set of arguments. And one of the things he said was that, and he didn't say it quite like this, but these cafeteria Catholics that want to accept some doctrines, throw out other doctrines, they all rest on the exact same foundation, which is the authority of the church, the canon of the Bible, teaching on the Eucharist, teaching on morality. If you throw out one, you basically have to throw out everything. But you have to buy into the whole enchilada, because if the church has this teaching authority, then you got to take the package. So, anyways, Mary, I was going to ask you, what was there anything in particular in that book, The Screwtape Letters, any conversations that they had in the book that really kind of struck you or that you remember as being like super powerful?
There was one in particular, but I couldn't remember what it was. So years later, I reread the book and it didn't have the same effect. I couldn't locate that exact, you know, chapter where it occurred, but it was, at the time, it was very profound. It just sort of slap me across the face that I'm wrong on this.
That's interesting. And I think sometimes books are like that, where a certain something that we might see, or even something, God can use anything. I mean, we might be watching a movie, and a movie might teach us, tell us something that we need to hear theologically. God can speak to us through all kinds of different ways. And sometimes when we read something, something can hit us. We need it at that time. But when we reread it, maybe it's not there that time. But yeah, that's definitely a great book by C.S. Lewis, The Screwtape Letters. And hey, Mary, thank you very much for calling in, and thank you for being so patient as we got the connection back.
Thank you, Cale.
Bye. Happy Thanksgiving to you. God bless you. That was Mary in Boston. 888-914-9149 is the number to call for the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. We're going to go back to our old friend in Youngstown, Ohio. Paul is on the line. Hey, Paul.
Cale.
Happy Thanksgiving in advance to you.
Oh, happy Thanksgiving. Just don't overdo it, because that's in 6 months until the walk to Mary.
The walk to Mary. I got to stay in shape. I know Father's probably already. And last time I was hanging out with him, he was wearing walk to Mary sunglasses. So he's already looking forward to that, quite literally, through his shades.
Huh. Okay. Well, my question was, you had mentioned earlier, you were talking about a person's conscience. And my question would be, sometimes you hear of criminals and things, and they say, well, they have no conscience. They're psychotic, or they're a psychopath. Are they judged differently by God, or do they actually have a conscience, and they've just suppressed it all their life, and they can't really use their conscience in a normal manner like a normal person could? What do you think about that?
That's an interesting question, Paul. I think in a lot of cases, you're talking about people who are dealing with mental illness as well. In some cases, not all, but in terms of the conscience, a lot of these criminals who have really become quite depraved. I mean, first of all, nobody comes out of the womb, in that sort of evil state, right? Like, things happen to people; they make choices. They harden their hearts. And this is one of the reasons why people should not put off conversion. A lot of people want to put off the God question until much later in life, as the Emperor Constantine, of course, famously did, who legalized Christianity in the Roman Empire. And he put off baptism, as many people did in the ancient world, until just before he died. And they knew that baptism would wash away not only the original sin and the guilt of that, which is imputed, but also any actual sins that people committed in their life prior to that point. And the church obviously still teaches that today. So, though I might have some sinning to do here, so I'd like to delay that, please, if possible. Well, the danger is that if you do that, there's no guarantee that you're actually going to want to come back to God later, because you might harden your heart and callous your heart so much. So sin has this kind of hardening effect that you might never get back there. You might never go to that confession. So I think you really have to be open to these waves of grace that are coming in, and really try to, when God is speaking to you, don't delay. But everybody has a conscience, and St. Paul talks about that, certainly in his letter to the Romans. That's one important point. In Romans chapter 1, he says this: the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images to be made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. So he's talking about idolatry there, obviously. And then he starts talking about how they start committing sins of impurity and all kinds of different sexual sins. You can read the passage, Romans chapter 1. It's incredibly powerful, and it essentially sums up what the world is like now as it was back then. Human nature really hasn't changed too much. And so this idea that even if somebody hasn't received formal religious instruction, they should know from the creation itself and from their conscience, the voice of eternity to the soul, that there is a God. And so nobody is without excuse, you know. That's an important point, I think, Paul. And it's so, and of course, God judges every person fairly and justly. No one's ever going to say, oh, God, you got this wrong. God knows the circumstances. He knows the history of each person. He knows how much of the truth that they know and how much they don't know, how free they were in their decision making. He factors all that in. And we certainly have to judge external actions as being sinful. But, you know, one thing we can't say is the eternal destiny of a person. That's only God knows that. Except for the saints, of course, we know they're in heaven. That's been revealed to us. But we got to be real careful about saying, you know, that person didn't make it. You know, you don't know that. You know, when somebody jumps off a bridge, that old saying, you know, between the bridge and the water, there was God, right? So repentance can happen at the very, very last second even. So don't wait until then. Don't wait until then. And certainly one thing we can do is try to help people to get back to God, to take that next step. And it's a good thing to ask yourself, is hopefully you're enjoying some of those meals with relatives, friends over the Thanksgiving weekend. What's the next step for this person? How can I get them closer to Christ? We all need to make that step. So as you're making your steps, safe travels to you and your loved ones over this holiday Thanksgiving weekend. Producer Jim Shaper, well, always does such a great job on the board. I really want to thank him. Speaking of Thanksgiving, for all his hard work, Thomas Essinger is sitting in for Patrick Alog, who's out on the left coast right now visiting family and friends. Please stay tuned to Relevant Radio. Hey, don't forget, tomorrow's our final episode of Old Covenant Controversies. It's been a great, great series. Is the Old Testament hopelessly out of date? We're going to be talking about morality tomorrow. Don't miss it. 12:30 Central on Relevant Radio. Stay tuned right now for Trending, followed by the Family Rosary Across America with Father Rocky. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. God bless.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.